gay men have a very specific journey because we are navigating our sexuality and our love, right? Our emotions.
Yeah, wow.
So the first thing we learn how to do is have sex. And then, because the sex cannot be connected to love, not in our generation. I think this new generation might be different, but you know.
Yeah, well, you were allowed to be in love and
we're gonna have sex and we're not gonna tell anybody we're doing that. We're gonna kiss, we're not gonna tell anyone we're doing that. We're gonna experiment, we're not gonna tell anyone we're doing that, and we're certainly not gonna fall in love.
Welcome back to Question the Self. This is your host, Jedediah Jenkins. This week on the show, Griffin Matthews. I'm just going to go right into this interview because it is so good and juicy and confessional and embarrassing that we need to go right into it. Griffin Matthews is an actor. He's a lead on the show The Flight Attendant and Dear White People, and I've known him for 20 years. He was one of the first gay friends I ever made, and he's gay and grew up in the church, and he was just always like one step ahead of me in some way or in development, and he was kind of a mentor to me, even though sometimes I was scared of what he was saying. But we talk about all that, and he's hilarious and asks scary questions, and you're gonna love it, maybe, or be offended and horrified. Enjoy.
What I'm supposed to not say.
Say anything.
Are there children listening to this?
It's open. It's in public platforms, okay, but
so let me just be careful. I'm not say all the dirty words.
Okay. So in my definition of celebrity, you are because you're on a big TV show.
Yes.
But you're a red carpet.
Yes. But I do think that I have theories about celebrity.
Okay.
I think that people can... People call things in. I think that I have friends who are really famous and they can walk right down the street and go to Target.
Interesting.
And then I have friends who cannot go to Target. And sometimes I think you probably could just go to Target.
But they don't think they can.
Or you've had a bad experience and now you feel like you can't go down. Stop it. Just go.
Yeah.
Just refuse it.
Refuse it.
I saw Mark Ruffalo on the train, reading on the train in New York City. Just go. Just do it. Just get on the train. And then people will see you, and then you'll be like, keep reading.
Ever watch Comedians in Cars or whatever with Jerry Seinfeld?
No, I've never.
He had Zach Galifianakis on, and Zach was saying, it's just so much being famous. And Jerry Seinfeld said, no, it's not. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And Zach's like, what? And he's like, you're a millionaire.
Yeah.
And you are a public person. Yeah. And you're in public. They can take a picture of you.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Just get into it. That's how I feel.
You would be, if you reached a level and you couldn't go to the grocery store without, that would be a problem.
I think the thing that actually, that I've experienced, not personally, but I've seen other people who are, friends of mine who are grocery store, cannot go. It's that they've had an experience where someone tried to hurt them.
Mm.
Mostly women. And that is when you get into see, I can't go there now. Or I just feel worried that someone might. It only takes one person. It doesn't take a bunch of people to hurt you. It's one person. And so when you get into the one person tried to hurt me moment, I think it scares the shit out of you.
I know multiple celebrities who have had not just death threats a tweet. Death threats here's a handwritten letter to your home.
To your mailbox.
I know where you live. I know your family's names.
That's it.
And then, that person could just be a teenager in Norway.
Correct.
Who knows?
Correct. And if that happened to me, I think I would maybe feel different.
Yes.
But I just worked on a project with a guy, black guy, celebrity. And he was very vocal about Black Lives Matter before it was 2020. And he was like, I got death threats into my mailbox and I had to move. And I'm like, yep.
Wow.
Especially when you have kids, you're like, okay, it's not that I'm worried that you're just going to hurt me. It's like, you'll abduct my kid or you'll, you know, and that's what So it does happen. I think there are people that literally cannot go down the street. I'm working on a project right now with Reese Witherspoon. She can't go down the street.
No.
No, stop it.
She can't even speak. And stop. I would hear that voice.
No. She can't even talk. Behind a mask. You're like, you're Reese Witherspoon. You know what I mean? And I watched Reese navigate the streets of New York City and I was like, wow, you can't even.
Even with a mask.
We were out, and I mean, we were shooting on the street in New York and I was just like, wow, she was being so gracious. She's so Southern. Mm-hmm. God bless her just for the Southern thing.
She went to high school right down the street from where I went to high school.
So just a belle. Yes. She's a Southern belle. So kind. And I just watched the energy that people are hitting her with. And it's fandom. It's not, no one's being mean to her. But oh my God, just all day, every day. Like she can't go anywhere because like she wouldn't go anywhere. Like she would get from the door to like two steps in and it would just be people losing their minds. So I was like, right, Reese can't go to Target.
Nope. Would you feel comfortable taking off your leather jacket?
Right now. Take it off. And what else? And what else?
That's step one. Okay. That's each question.
I asked you.
Each question.
Came into this garage. I said, this is where the bodies are kept. Hey, would you take off that leather coat of yours? And
okay, so that's the sound of wine being poured. We're having fun here in my garage.
Take that shirt off. No, what was that?
Now you heard that. Listener, did you hear that?
What was it?
That was an accident.
Was that an accident?
Well, Glendale Boulevard right here was a very busy street. Yeah, that sounded serious.
That was a big boom.
Do we look?
Can we see?
I don't know. Unless it's in a very small sliver, no. We'll hear sirens and then we'll look. Hopefully we don't hear sirens.
Yeah, that was it.
Griffin, I've known you so long that
200 years.
That I knew you with a different name.
That's right.
And it was like, you were my first experience and someone choosing to change their name. And then it was like, I need to respect that. Even though it wasn't based on anything other than a career choice, I would guess. Or is it more like, did you change it?
I know, it's a good question. Well, first of all, I was born in the 80s, and I feel like all of our mothers decided to call us Matthew. And it was like, are you a Matthew? Are you an Andrew? Are you a Jonathan? Mm-hmm. Which are you? And I was like, I can't. I had a head full of dreadlocks, and I was like super gay. And I was just like, I can't be a Matt. Are you serious? P.S. I married a Matt. Matt's sister married a Matt. So technically, when we are at Thanksgiving with all of the Jews, there are three Matts in a house. That's too much.
Yeah.
Most of my friends call me Griffin. I played sports and I was like in, you know, social activities and everyone called me Griffin or Griff. And so like making the transition into Griffin was like, it was easy.
Your energy and personality and existence has always captivated me from the moment I met you. Not only because you were my best friend's like best friend from home back in the day, but also there was a liberty in the way you move because I was gay then and yet I was very much Christian and locked in that world in a major way. And you moved in a way that to me felt like liberation while still singing in church, still doing your thing where I was like, I want to move in that direction. And it's so funny that back then, you were Matthew Griffin to me, and you were never Matt or Matthew. Mm-hmm. You were a full name, Matthew Griffin. And I don't know. It's funny that you labeled yourself Matt when I never. That's like shocking to hear that people called you Matt because you're so clearly not. But how did you? When I met you in 2001, what was your inner world at the time? Were you grew up in the church? You knew you were gay, you were like free and clear, or you were like working on it or what?
Oh, working on it and still working on it to this day. I don't know if you're always working on it. It's like you can't, I have kids now, so I am so aware that everything we're pouring into them is building them. It's the building blocks of who they will be and what they'll deal with for the rest of their lives. And so I think that God, I just had a long, long, long conversation with my mother just about, I'm going to be 40 this year. And I said to her, I've never, ever questioned if you loved me, but I did question and do question if you like me. And she had an idea. Parents have ideas of who their kids are going to be. I have an idea of who my sons will be. And I imagine if one day they wake up and say, Dad, I am something other than what you thought I was going to be, with all of the work that you put in and with all of your liberation as a parent, my son could turn around and be like, Dad, I want to be something else. Mm. And I would have to deal with re-meeting them.
Don't you feel like that's inevitable?
Yes, but...
In degrees.
It's in degrees. You know, my mother was raised in a really, really Christian Pentecostal environment. So I think when I sort of was gay and I never had to come out of the closet because I was just gay. Come on, look at me. Listen to me. I've always been this. I was never able to hide it. It was just always that. So like, I think that...
Meaning in eighth grade, someone was like, are you gay? And you said yes? Or you said...
No.
You said what?
In eighth grade, it was all of the bad words. It was, you know? So everybody knew that I was different. I'm the middle boy of three boys. And I was just like, my older brother was so straight. And I was so gay. Yeah. I wanted Barbies and My Little Pony. I didn't want to play in the dirt. I liked girly things. And I was just like, nowadays, everyone's like, oh, your son is gay.
Yeah, cool.
Stop. Like, he wants to address it. We love it. He's gay.
Hold on.
Hold.
It might be happening.
Okay, you hear those sirens. There was a big crash, and I hope they're okay, but we did go check, and we couldn't see anything. So, life in Los Angeles. Wow. Back to the show.
It's funny that you say that, because I always knew my mom loved me and liked me.
Mm.
And yet that still isn't enough, because I wanted her to approve of me.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. It's the approval. And when there isn't the approval, it creates an insecurity. So maybe that's a better... You've maybe said it better than what I said, which is, I think my mom always liked me. It's the approval portion.
Yeah.
It was the approval. And I felt that differently, because my brothers felt like they had her approval. And I was always like, why are you doing it like that? Why do you have to do like that? Why are you dressing like that? Why are you doing that to your hair? It was just the approvals.
Yes.
And that can happen to any parent, regardless of sexuality. You can be like, I don't like that you want to dye your hair green.
Oh, when I talked to Jessica Malotti Rivera, she was like, to this day, my parents are upset that I'm not a doctor, medical doctor.
Correct.
And she's like, I'm thriving in my expertise. And they're proud of her,
right.
But they're still like, but you could go do the other thing we want you to
That's right.
Which, my ribs. I'm dying. I have a rib problem that I'll edit out or leave in. I don't know what it is. So in 2001, take me there. I had decided I wasn't going to act on my sexuality because I wasn't sure. I was sure I was gay, and I was sure I didn't choose it.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But I wasn't sure that it was okay with God, because I had been told and taught that sometimes God challenges people with mm-hmm. extra special burdens
mm-hmm.
that they are uniquely mm-hmm. equipped to overcome.
Correct.
And that's actually this like thing to be proud of, that God would trust your spirit with such a heavy thing, and that like, you know, the heart is deceitful above all things is like a verse they love to use against little gay boys and girls. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I don't know more than 3,000 years of Judeo-Christian history. This is my one and only life. I'm not going to go against this yet. And so I'm going to wait until God answers the question for me. How did you process Jesus and the church and the Bible when you were in your early 20s?
The deeper question is, how did I process you when I met you?
Go on.
You were so confusing to me, because you were holding a line that I was like, how are you holding this line? First of all, I was coming from Pittsburgh and I came to Southern California. I'd never been to Southern California. And I stepped onto USC's campus and I literally, my mouth dropped. I could not believe all of the beautiful men. I've never seen anything like it. And then you were like, oh, this is my friend. And this is my other friend. And this is my other
gorgeous man. Gorgeous
man. My. And you were like, no. God has called me. I said, listen, God ain't called me. Can he call me? Because God ain't called me.
No.
Is he available?
Number blocked.
Is the number on? Put it on my phone, Jesus. I was like, Jed, how are you surviving this? Because I didn't feel like I had the same temptations. USC campus? I was like, This is a whorehouse. This but is the gay boys' no. whorehouse.
But did you...
you're blushing.
Did you see... Yeah, okay, but were you, like, openly gay, having boyfriends, living your life?
No, I was still in college when I came to...
Yeah,
to
visit.
Visit, and I did not have my first boyfriend until after I graduated. So I was still very much wrestling with my sexuality and how to justify it. I was still very much involved in Christian campus crusades and all of that stuff. I was still really like trying to find my way through it, but I was also in drama school.
Right.
And so if you go to drama school, mm-hmm. they're going to work that out of you.
You're not doing that anymore.
Oh, baby. Your freshman year, week one, they're like, oh, he's a gay boy. Go get him. Get him. Take the shirt
Fresh
off.
Meat. Yeah.
Kiss him. Do you like? It was like, stop.
So you were kissing boys, having sexual experiences.
I was not having any sexual experiences. I was kissing boys. But that was the extent.
And were you stopping it?
It was, I didn't know what to do next. You know? Like, gay men have a very specific journey because we are navigating our sexuality and our love, right? Our emotions.
Yeah, wow.
So the first thing we learn how to do is have sex. Wow. And then, because the sex cannot be connected to love, not in our generation. I think this new generation might be different, but you know.
Yeah, well, you weren't allowed to be in love and then have sex.
We're gonna have sex and we're not gonna tell anybody we're doing that. We're gonna kiss, we're not gonna tell anyone we're doing that. We're gonna experiment, we're not gonna tell anyone we're doing that, and we're certainly not gonna fall in love. And if we fall in love, that's an unspoken. We don't need to talk about that portion. Whereas I think early on, kids who are, you know, identify as straight, it's all about love. It's all about the love stories. There's love stories in our entire culture, right? So they're told love is a possibility for you. When you're gay in the 90s, 2000s, you're not told that's an option. Mm. So, and boys are hornballs anyways.
Yeah, especially you know? At that age.
At that age, that's all but you're always, doing. I guess. You know, so yeah, anyways, when I came to LA and I met you in that space, you felt farther behind in your truth telling about, I was like, Jed,
mm-hmm.
I don't know how you can sleep at night. All these boys walking around shirtless in this apartment. What's happening? Somebody ring the bell. What's happening? What's happening?
I remember you asking me pointed questions like that. And of course, no one else would ask me that ever. Like, no one else, because everyone was Christian and they were, like, straight or thought they were straight. So they were, like,
correct.
They actually felt that, like, friendship with me was this, like, a service and mm-hmm. tokenism, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But then also, like, they're helping me by certainly not encouraging me to, like, kiss boys.
Right.
And you would be like, who are you kissing? you better not lie. And I'm like, no one.
I know.
And you'd be like, you are lying.
You're lying to me.
I wasn't lying.
We were under the covers on the floor of the Medici or whatever. And I was like, tell me everything. Who are you kissing? How are you getting through this life? And you were like, no one. And I could not understand.
I remember we were in Pennsylvania in Dan's basement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we were down there and you said to me, I'll never, because like, as you're like almost like a gay mentor to me because you're like the first person who was like liberated in my life.
Yeah.
And you said, Jed, you have beautiful skin.
Oh my God.
And I was like, it was to have a gay man compliment me was probably the first time that had ever happened. And it went into my limbic brain, my lizard brain, as the most validating, like, I mean, I'd gotten compliments, you know, in other ways all my life, but that one little thing. It's so visceral to me that I know exactly where I could walk us to the place where we were sitting.
Okay. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
You are one of the most attractive people I've ever met. Take that. Mm-hmm. Put that on tape.
Mm-hmm.
You're one of the most attractive people that I have ever met in my life, which is you have the unique ability to pull people in. And they feel like they are the only thing on planet Earth with Jed. And that's why I was like, how are you surviving all of this? Because the attention that you get from men and women and everyone is intense.
Hmm.
So I was seeing you and I was like, oh, he's the most attractive person anyone's ever seen. because you are moving with so much confidence and so much, strangely enough, clarity about the human condition that I think people just feel like so seen by you.
Mm. Whoa.
So, and then you do have nice skin.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I
do you feel attractive? I always wondered. I was always like, does Jed feel like he's hot or does he feel like...
That is a true journey for me.
You were so nerdy then.
Yes.
But I always was like, oh, he's so attractive.
Yeah. It is a lifelong... I know that some people find me attractive.
Yeah.
But there's somebody out there for everybody.
Yeah.
I don't think like that. And I had a lot of insulation from thinking like that. So to the degree that... To this day, when I go to a party, let's say I go to a party, I don't know anybody.
Yeah.
And I see everyone. And then later in the night, maybe I make a friend or two, maybe whatever. And someone says, I noticed you when you walked in, or I've been watching. And I'm like, no, you didn't. No one can see me. I see.
Mm-mm.
You don't see.
Mm-mm.
I see.
Mm-mm.
It like, it is, you know, some people walk into a room and all they can feel is everyone looking at them in a negative way. They're mm-hmm. like, no one wants me here. Mm-hmm. Or they're like, they think I'm a piece of meat, but I actually love music and I'm creative, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel truly invisible, not in a negative way, in a way where I am completely like, I talk to who I want to, but until I speak to you, I don't exist. Isn't that interesting? And it is not negative at all. That's why I love going to parties. I feel no self-consciousness. I am a ghost.
But maybe that's why you're so attractive to people, because you're not judging the experience. You're great.
I'm really
at
not.
Parties. You're great one-on-one. You're so great. That's what I mean. The world goes away and it's you and the other person.
Mm.
You have the unique ability to have literally 1,000 best friends. And I think that everybody who says Jed is my best friend means that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's bullshit in there. I think they mean that. And I think you mean that.
I do.
So that's unique and that's attractive. And I think that as I've gotten older, I realize what attractiveness actually is. It's not necessarily having big muscles or having, you know,
right,
clear skin or anything like that. It's actually, do you have the ability to see and be seen?
Hmm.
And that is when you meet celebrities, as we were talking about earlier, a lot of times you'll meet celebrities, people that you're like, child, I don't like them, and they're bad, I hate that movie, they're bad. You'll meet them and they have a light and you're like, holy,
you're a star.
Oh my god,
there's a reason.
You might be a terrible actor, you have a light though. The light
Different.
Is on. And I have seen those people, I've worked with them, I met them at events, and you're like, wow, there's a real light in you.
You have that from the day.
Stop.
I'm telling you.
Now I'm going to melt.
I told you, you were a first and last name from the moment I met you, not just in a mentor way, but in a way you move through the room and exist and ask questions. The way, there is never a moment that I've been around you where you don't show up and you are the star. This, you know, like when a spotlight goes, yoosh. It doesn't matter who else is in the room. I know it to be true. I can't imagine somebody. And I think there is something that I've always found rest in you also, because I'm not like tap dancing or trying to get any attention, but like, I love to tell a story. I love to talk. I love whatever. And when I'm around you, I like just giggle and relax. I'm pouring more wine.
I know. That's why you're relaxing. You're giggling because there's wine and...
I'm relaxed.
You're relaxed.
So
yeah.
Tell me, I want to know...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. ASMR. With my writing and with the stories that I tell online and just the way that I am, I find that I attract a lot of Christian or deconstructing Christians who are trying to figure out their sexuality or... their place in this world where they don't know if the way that they were raised to believe what they believe fits in the real world. Mm-hmm. And like, you grew up in the church singing, like doing the whole thing, and you were visibly, as you said, gay to the point where nobody could like be shocked.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have people be like, you can't sing in this church? Or
I wrote an entire musical about it.
Mm.
Witness Uganda is a musical that Matt and I wrote, and it starts, the impetus of that show was I was singing in a church in New York City, a very like hip liberal, liberated church. And when the pastor found out that I was gay, they asked me to step down from being a worship leader. And that was so traumatic. I was 23 years old. I was in New York City.
And God, that feels so young.
I was so young. And I didn't even realize how young I was until the older you get, you're like, oh my God, I was so young. And it was like an uproar, caused an uproar inside of the church, because at the time the church was also like hiring musicians, like outside musicians to play in the...
Like non-Christians.
Yeah. And I was like, so I'm a Christian and I'm gay and I'm singing in the choir and on microphone, and this lady over here plays the cello and you've paid her $100 to be here, and she can play the cello for Jesus and I can't sing for Jesus. Somebody help me. Okay, then pay me.
Pay me.
Then pay me. Can you imagine? I should have said that.
Just pay me.
I should have said it to the man. Pay me. But there were, I remember my friend had been living with his girlfriend. He was a Broadway guy. So I was in like a theater community in New York, and he got married at the church. The pastor married him. He and his girlfriend had been living together for years. And I was like, so you going to marry these two? And I'm up
living
here,
in sin.
Baby, where? What's the line?
Yes.
Somebody tell me what the line is. I didn't get the memo. And that was a real breakdown and break in my journey as a man and as a Christian. And it was rough. And so Witness Uganda, the musical that I wrote.
Which is amazing.
It tackles being black and gay and Christian and my personal experience inside of trying to make all of the pieces, the oddity of my life in New York City. And also I was working in Uganda at the time to just like try to, how do I make it all make sense? God, why did you put me in all of these places at the time? Uganda was one of the most dangerous places in the world to be gay. And that was the country that I was working in. I had no idea when I went to Uganda the first time. So, you know, I got caught in this, like, this washing machine. It was just, I was getting stirred and stirred and stirred. And I kind of felt like, oh God, this must be heading for something. I didn't know what it was.
Were you like, I'm done with the church and Jesus? Or...
Never really Jesus, more the church. The idea of Jesus as like being a Christ follower, right? Like, okay, so I just follow that guy's teachings, but I didn't want to deal with the church.
Yeah, because it wounded you.
Yeah, oh boy. That was, and the crazy thing is that it was always wounding me. I just wasn't willing to see that. My at the time I was dating, you know, this Jewish guy, and when he would come to church with me, he was around for that little period, and he was like, how are you doing this? You don't see that every time you walk in them doors, that's a wound. And so I married that Jewish guy. But so I think that I was getting wounded all over the place. I'm not saying that church is a bad thing. I'm just saying that when you're gay, trying to grow up in the church and be active in the church, I don't know if it's a great thing. Unless your church is open and affirming, it's not a great thing, because then you're hiding.
Something you said just brought to mind how now, feeling so comfortable and free in my sexuality, in my spirituality, feeling totally integrated, or at least wildly more integrated than I've ever been. When I hear that like a church is like non-affirming or anti-gay, one of the great things about getting older is that you actually see that things change. Mm-hmm. They can change for the worse, correct, but they can change for the better. I mean, living in LA, weed is just legal.
Baby.
It's just, oh, you want to go to a beautiful store where there's like, it's like buying an Apple product. Correct. It's like a beautiful box. Correct. And you get this. Correct. It's the most beautiful thing. That was illegal. Correct. 5 minutes ago.
Correct.
And the way that people's minds can change. Mm-hmm. And now thinking back about the way that I felt about this integral part of me. And what's so interesting about being a gay man in the church, a gay person. And I'm sure that blends into non-binary gender identity things. Mm-hmm. Is the way that the church also stigmatizes sex itself.
Oh my God.
And sexual intimacy. Yeah. And so... they try to divorce sexual intimacy from like true identity in Christ. And they're like, of course you can be wild. You can be buck wild when you get married. Mm-hmm. But it's like, what your desire should actually be sacrificed or like nailed to the cross. Mm-hmm. And so it also felt shameful that a part of my identity was rooted in my desire to have sex and intimacy with men, because that's also, sex is also a bad thing. Mm-hmm. So then it's like where I put it and what, not put it, but where I put my attraction and the attraction itself mm-hmm. is a double whammy.
Yes.
Is like such a, because I think that's what kept me, I was not in the closet, but what kept me celibate and trying so hard to fit into that story is that they had convinced me that like sexual intimacy is so holy that it has to, it can only possibly be in one pre-decided framework.
Correct.
Which, I mean, by the way, lots of people still believe. And that's like, that's their belief.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that's the unique fucking double whammy of it. And then you have the triple whammy of being a Black gay man. Mm-hmm. I remember last year during everything that happened, our racial reckoning, the one of our lifetime, the biggest one of our lifetime. And sincere white people that I knew were asking their Black friends to explain things. Mm-hmm. Like, I've never thought about this before. Mm-hmm. And I would see this happen online. And the Black friend would be, I'm so tired. Mm-hmm. Just don't. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, this is your chance to explain it. They're asking and they really want to know. Mm-hmm. And then I remembered, I have had so many people ask me now at this stage, how do you reconcile homosexuality with the Bible? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm not answering that. Mm-hmm. That is the weight of my life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I can't imagine the double whammy.
It was the double whammy. 2020 was the double, triple whammy, I think, for Black people, and certainly Black people who identify as being part of the LGBTQ plus community. So we were tired. I tried to stay less tired, but I got tired. I got tired. And I really understood when other Black people were like, I'm tired. I'm not answering these questions. Because it was just, it was an assault. It was like the pandemic on top of like the assault of, you know, the racial reckoning. And then white people asking us questions. And I'm like, bitch, I had to learn that shit when I was 3.
Yeah.
So like catch up, read a book, watch a movie, cry to your mom. But please don't call me.
Mm.
You know?
You have a lot of white friends.
I'm married to a white person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were probably that text for a lot of people.
Yes. I was that text for a lot of people. Which is why I say I was trying to stay open and available to the people in my life that I love and wanted to interact with. But I also was like, I was on a podcast by this guy who I really...
How dare you bring that up?
Yeah, I know. He was... It's not nearly as good as this podcast. But he said to me, asked me a question. He said, when did you stop caring about white feelings? And I had to pause because I was like, whoop! He's a Black guy. Black gay man. And I was like, let me really think about that. And then I thought about it and I said, it wasn't that I stopped caring about white feelings. It was that I started caring about mine.
Hmm.
And that is a very hard shift when you're a brown person in this country. We have been conditioned to care about your feelings mm-hmm. before our feelings.
Mm.
My grandmothers were cleaning women and they raised white kids. And my grandfathers were janitors and security guards. It was always about white people's feelings. Mm. My mother sat us down when we turned 16 and told us about the police. And if you get stopped, you pull over into a well-lit area. You keep your hands on the steering wheel. We were conditioned to be afraid of the police. I grew up in suburbia, white suburbia. And my mother was like, if you see a police officer and they pull you over, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. Keep your hands on the wheel. Mm. Don't you get into a lit area so that everyone can be seen. And, you know, you can be seen. They can see you. It was so when I married Matt, I asked him, like, when you turned 16, did Debbie and Joe say that to you? And he was like, no.
No, me neither. Not even.
No. I was shocked. I thought that was the speech that all kids get. And Matt was like, no, never got that speech. We would never get that speech. Why would we? The police are our friends. They're here to help us. If you can get a little attitude with the police, they're, you know.
Totally.
I was like, oh, my God. So anyways, that the 2020 for me was relearning how to care about my feelings. relearning how to care about my feelings. Mm. And in our industry, I sat through so many forums and for, you know, Hollywood and Broadway. And we got into it. Listening to Black actors inside of a closed forum to major networks, major studios, talking about what it felt like to be a Black actor. I'm talking like there are Black celebrities on there. Sharing their experiences for the first time with white executives of these major studios and networks. It was deep. The way we have like divorced ourselves from our feelings when we've seen our white co-stars, you know, with that hair and makeup trailer is a war zone. It used to be a war zone. Because you step in at 5 a.m. and no one can do your hair. Nobody can do your makeup. And your white co-star is sitting there at the spa. And I'm like, why? She came in her pajamas. Why did she step out of this trailer looking like $1 million? And I step out of the trailer and go into my private trailer and start fixing my hair and makeup. Wow. I have a kit in my book bag and I start, you know, refixing the things that don't work. And I was like that. And I've never said anything. I don't say anything because I'm scared. I don't want to get fired. I don't want to tell anybody what's going on. And that story was, oh my God. Oh my God. It was all over our industry. So anyways, I say that to say that I don't believe me, just believe that what I heard in all those forums were that Black people in America have divorced themselves from their own feelings. Mm. And so we are relearning ourselves. Relearning ourselves. So, yeah.
I'll never forget, I was dating a Black man.
Mm-hmm. Me?
You. Yeah. And I was reading this fantastic Zadie Smith article in the New Yorker, and she was talking about the fetishization of Black bodies or something.
Yes.
And she said, you know, people just will walk up to a Black man and touch their biceps and just be like, and then I would realize I am
one of those people.
I was like, what was so interesting is in that moment, it made me embarrassed to be attracted to my boyfriend because I felt like I was some pawn in a system of oppression.
Yeah.
I wasn't just loving the person that I loved. It was like, oh God, I'm this cog in a machine. What have you learned marrying?
I don't know how to respond to that.
Oh my God, Siri, I'm not asking you the deepest questions of society.
How did that even happen?
Send it, whatever the text is. Look at all those words.
I don't know how to respond. That just happened on my...
You're allowed to say what she said.
We've been listening, like they're listening to us right now.
Tim Cook is like, that's a great question. But so what is, what's something surprising about marrying a white Jewish man where you're like, oh, I thought that would be not a thing and it is a thing. Or I thought this would be a thing and it's not.
Well, my husband's only attracted to Black men. That's his preference.
Great.
And he says that his preference started, I'm speaking for him, but he ain't here, so I'll say it. He said it started when he was in the Peace Corps in Mauritania for 2 years. He lived in the desert of West Africa for 2 years after college. And
cool.
He said it was the first time he was like alone in a desert full of Black men, Black Muslim men. And he was like, what is this? Like, why do they look like that? It was like, he was like, I lived my whole life. He was raised in LA. He was like, I lived my whole life with like white people. Then I went to school in Boston, more white people. And then I got on a plane and flew to West Africa. And I was like, this is what Black people look like? This is what Black bodies look like? They're gorgeous. And so he was like, from that point on, he was like, I just wanted Black men. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I have dated Black men and white men and everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
I like everything. I'm one of those gays. Like, I like everything. I like them big. I like them short. I like them tiny.
Me too.
You know, like, I don't have, that's not a thing for me.
I have a caveat to that, but I'll explain in a minute, but keep going.
Yeah, so I don't think it's a problem, but I do think the idea of fetishizing Black bodies, that is inside of our culture. Strangely enough, I think like my experience of that was always happening in the dark, in the underground, or in the dark.
Your sneaky little moments.
Yeah, sneaky moments. And then someone says some, you know, and then you're like, what did you?
You're like, you're trying to be freaky, but that's weird.
That's too much. What's that about? Oh my God, I was just having dinner with a friend of mine, Black gay man. I hope I don't say too much, but he was like, he asked me, do you know any black men who like to be dommed by white men? And I said, no. And he was like, yeah, it makes me really uncomfortable. Like, I'm, you know, I've been seeing somebody and they particularly the white guy and he wants to dom me. And I'm like, not okay. Something doesn't let me do it. And I'm like, because that's some culture and some history. You're not about to dom me. It's not happening. You're not about to hit me. It's not going down. Not with a black guy. It's not. So we launched into this whole conversation about race and historical references as to why, like, black men. Look, I'm speaking with he and I, right? I'm sure there are some black guys who want to be dogged.
Yeah, great.
Good for you. Call me and tell me how that is, because I don't know anything about it.
You're waiting from calls from God. I'm waiting for calls from Doms.
Like, my phone is on, Jesus. I'm on the main line. But I was like, oh, this is like cultural. Like, we don't want there's a line where we feel like, are you trying to give me Massa Reynolds? I'm not trying to be, you know, some slave to you. Mm. And so anyways, that's inside of all of us. If it's inside of me, it's inside of you.
Yes.
I was raised in the same country you were raised in. So anyways, I'm always like, let me check myself. You check yourself and let's come to the table and see if we can, you know, enjoy each other's bodies and enjoy each other's minds. And
the conversation, I have like gone a little deep or just gotten like in the weeds of the problematic nature and yet universal nature of sexual preference.
Right.
Because like having a preference for almost anything is rejecting another body type. You know, if you only like fit men, then you like
don't like
fat shame, whatever it is, or skinny or whatever it is. It's like, and in our moment of giving everyone the chance to shine and everyone the dignity of their own sexual attraction and their own sexual energy, which I find to be amazing. Mm-hmm. And as you get older, you realize how wide the net really is. Especially if you're single, you're like, you'll meet somebody that was not even on your radar.
Right.
And then they say something, they look a certain way, they make a joke, they move a certain way. And I'm like, are you the most attractive person I have ever?
Correct.
The opposite of that is then you finally get to like make out with the hottest quote unquote guy you've ever seen. And then you're like, this is trash.net. It's not even a real website.
Correct.
So that's an update. For me.
That's an update. Yes.
For me, I realized, and this is something that I'm working through, and I'm sure God will strike me for this and deliver me the opposite of what I'm saying. I have found that I am attracted to almost any type of man that does not look like me.
Great.
And I don't know what that means, but I'm going to tell you what I think it means. I am attracted to Hispanics, Asians, Blacks, Indians, whatever it is, but not bearded white men. And I think the reason why is there is something that I subconsciously envy about the heterosexual experience, where there is an otherization between the two sexes, where a man, you know how you see these gays where they look identical.
I've seen them.
They look the same person are dating each other.
Yes.
And that is fine. God bless.
God bless God.
But I love, like, when I'm with someone who doesn't look like me, I'm looking at their skin. I'm looking at their hair. I'm looking at, and I'm like, and then they're like touching my chest hair or something. And I'm like, my chest hair, who cares? But to them, it's a wonder. The way their body is a wonder to me.
Jed, my husband's a hairy Jew, a ginger hairy Jew. We have fights when he shaves off his body hair. We have fights. We don't have them anymore, but we used to.
Why would he shave it off?
Because he doesn't know. I said, let me help you. Let me help you. I don't have any hair. I'm hairless. Look at me. Look at me. This is not a shave.
It's incredible.
Look at it. I don't know how. I literally have asked some questions like, so at what point, like one day you woke up and you had hair on your chest?
It was traumatizing, by the way.
What happened?
Yes.
He says the same thing. And I love that he has hair on his chest and he has hair on his neck and things that I don't have that. And so, yes, I've had similar experience. I've been with men who are black and hairless, and it's been lovely. But I think the idea for me, sexuality is just, it's at its best when you're actually interested in the other person.
Exactly.
It's at its best when you're interested. When I'm like, what is that little groove?
Okay, you were about to read me for filth when I said, I was like, I had been seeing this guy, and I was like, I don't know. Like, I just want to hang on his every word. That's what I'm looking for.
I hate it.
Why do you hate that? Because I don't want to just, like, have a normal conversation. I want to find them to be magical. Don't you think Matt is magical?
I do. He's totally magical, but not always. What are you talking about?
Right, but in the beginning, that's the point. You have to be lured in. Tell me about falling in love with your husband, and then you can read me for filth.
He was magical. He was definitely magical. We were friends, you know, for maybe a year before we started dating, and we would see each other, you know, as friends occasionally. And he was magical because he had another experience. He had already been to the Peace Corps. He'd already spent time in Africa. And so he was already a lover of black men. Mm. And I felt that immediately when we started talking. He was interested in me in a way that I felt other men had not been. He thought I was beautiful in a way that other men did not always think that I was beautiful. I was skinny. And he was like, you're built like a West African. Which also, P.S., is like so... That's why Africa is so life-changing for people of color, black people. Because you gotta see yourself. If you're growing up in America, you're not always seeing yourself. You don't see where it came from. And so Matt was always like... Because, you know, I had body issues. And I don't know, why am I so skinny? And da-da-da. He was like, you're a West African.
He's like, you're exactly what you're supposed to be.
Your nose is too big. I like the big nose. Your lips are too big. I like the big lips. I like that you're hairless. I like all that. You're an African. And I never had a white person, or even a black person for that matter, tell me that I felt like an African to them.
Wow.
You know, so.
You also had Africans call you white.
Correct.
In Uganda.
Right. When you go to Uganda, they're like, you're not an African. You're as white as snow. Please leave.
You're like, excuse me.
Excuse me?
Trauma.
Yeah, more trauma. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, like there was... So Matt saw me, and that was the first thing that was magical, that he saw me. And I had never dated a Jewish person. And so, of course, when you're Christian, you're like, you crucified our Lord and Savior. And now I'm like, why am I attracted to you? What's happening? You crucified our friend. You know what I mean?
Our teacher.
So that we got into, we had really robust conversations around Judaism and around where we split Jews and Christians and the whole thing. We just had so much to talk about. And he was so angry about the state of the world. I think Jews are, you know, New York, his parents are New York Jews, and they're like angry about everything.
I thought you said he's from LA.
I know, the New York Jews moved to LA to escape New York. You can't even believe it's real.
He gives New York to me, but I don't know why.
Well, that's because Debbie and Joe are Bronx, baby. Him. Baby. So we just had a lot of that anger. I also understood, because for him, he was like, when I grew up in LA, my father sat me down and said, don't you ever tell anybody you're Jewish. Don't you ever, because Jews were like, listen. And so I was like, I understand that, you know, like I understand the need to fit in and survive and hide and don't be, you know, too obvious. And even though I was black, some of my white friends used to say, you know, my mother would never let me date a black guy, but you would be okay.
Yeah.
Which meant that I was somehow hiding, you know, yes. Like somehow I was not a black guy to them. I was, you know,
something Griffin. Else.
I was something else. I was safe. And so anyway, so Matt and I had a lot of connections in that. I say all that to say that, like, do I hang on his every word? No, you can't. We've been together for 13 years. I do not hang on his every word. But what I do hang on to is that I feel seen. And then I see him, and sometimes he's so boring, and I love that he's boring sometimes.
But what is the thing when you are dating someone, what is the thing where you realize, oh, this could be, this could be the long haul. Like, when did that switch?
Well, I honestly thank God that I was in the generation right before the apps, because the apps are destroying everybody. The fact that you always feel like you can swipe.
Go fishing. Just throw that back in the pond.
We didn't have it. If you wanted to go fishing, you had to go to the gay bar on a Friday night and like get dressed up and put on cologne and just try to hope for the best. Save your weekly coins and go, you know, buy drinks. It was the worst. But you guys, you have apps, and so everything can be swiped. So anyways, sometimes I wonder if your generation or I guess we're the same generation, but I just wonder.
But I'm like single inside of this moment. Well, I will say, the silver lining to that shitstorm that you're talking about is me as somebody who lived asexually for so long. Mm-hmm. And then had these like weird romantic friendships that were so toxic, and
I had them too.
Millions.
Yeah.
The apps save me, because now I really know I'm on a date. I know that no one can say, "Oh, whoa, I thought we were just," because listen, I know people want to talk to me. I'm fun. Mm-hmm. I am fun. You want to hang out with me? Of course you do. I am a dream. But do you want to kiss me? Probably not.
Baby.
But if I met you on an app, you better know a kiss is coming.
That's
If there's a vibe.
That's right.
To me, clarity saves me.
Yes. Yes.
So there are millions of problems with it, but there are, are things that are
You're
great.
Clear what's going on.
I'm like,
okay. You like boys, and we're on this app together to like boys. No, true. That makes full sense. I just think the thing to be looking for in a partner, it's like, can I build an empire with this person?
Mm.
It's like a little, you know, Indian.
So you're like, you're dating someone for a few months, and what are the questions you're asking yourself?
Can this person, now I'm old.
No. You're married. I'm saying, like, what would you give advice?
But I'm saying I'm old. So I'm going to tell you what I am as, you know.
Interesting.
How old are you?
Your age. I'm
baby. We're not young. So you're about to tell you what I'm asking. Can I build an empire with this person?
Mm-hmm.
Can I have a companion in this person? Can I hold on to this person and learn and travel and grow? It's like we watched that Indian matchmaking show on Netflix. It's so good. But those are the questions that parents are, when they're putting them together, they're arranging their marriages. It's not always about like, you know, how do you feel? It's like, baby, does this work? Is this person going to pay bills?
Mm-hmm.
Is this person going to give you children? Is going to give you the house and the home and the things that you need to survive in this world? And so sometimes I think we like get so caught up in like, someone come on the horse, gallop and pick me up and sweep me off my feet. Cut that shit out. You'll be single for the rest of your life. Cut it out.
So you didn't feel that with Matt? You didn't feel swept off
Matt
your feet?
Matt was my most adult decision. I had other men that I was crazy. Romeo and Juliet. I'm gonna fall on a sword. What's happening? Help me! Mom, help! Oh my God! And Matt was the first guy that wasn't that. And I was like, oh, this is a little boring. I'm into it.
I'm
not trying to fall on another sword.
The way that
shit hurt.
How long have you been with Matt?
Too long. Too damn long.
Tell me years.
We started dating in 2008.
All I will say is I have hung out with you very recently. And the way that you talk to each other, the way that you laugh and bicker, and to me it is truly aspirational. Because what is very clear to me is that you hear each other.
We love each other. It's crazy.
Yeah, like you really care what joke the person's gonna make.
Oh yeah.
And it's so fresh.
We're in tune. We're in tune with each other. But that is years in the making. That we were not always in tune. There was a lot of friction in the beginning. Rough years. When people used to tell me like, you know, my husband and I, we went through years where we didn't like each other. I'm like, I used to hear that story and be like, what are you talking about? Years? Now I'm like, baby, there have been years. Spans of time when I was like, I don't really know if you're the guy. I'm not sure if you're the guy.
And then things change. Like, what happens?
People go through things.
Yeah.
If you partner with someone, you're going to live through their nonsense and your nonsense and all of the nonsense. You got to live through it. And then they come out of it.
Right.
And you're like, oh, so you were in the valley. And now you're on the up. So you got to love me when I'm in a valley. You got to love me when I'm on top, love me when I'm on the bottom. You know, you got to really, so as you stay together long enough, there will be like seasons. That phrase, season, that word, there are seasons. Mm-hmm. That's a real thing. That's
there's
not
a
just,
winter in
that
there.
Baby, she's long and she's cold and she's dark.
It's a Boston winter. It's not Miami.
That's it. Put on your boots. So they've had winters.
Mm-hmm.
We're currently in a summer.
Mm. I feel that.
We're in a really good space, which is so exciting.
Okay. We might end it right now, but I want to give you. I want to do a 10-minute addendum, which is. Do you have 10 more minutes?
Yeah.
Kenny might be home. I turned off my phone because it was blowing up. Because I'm
Cameron
popular.
Here?
I wanna be.
That's my friend.
Kristen Chenoweth.
Stephen Schwartz.
I go right to the star, not the true star, which
the
is
true
the
true star
the
is
mind,
the man who wrote it.
The mind. I have a dream, and this is a dream that I'm willing to let go of. Mm-hmm. Like, what I really do try to embody the release of expectation, mm-hmm. and the embrace of what is with the tango of, like, I do want things. Mm-hmm. And I do want children. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel called to babies, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I feel called to fostering to adopt mm-hmm. maybe 5, 6, 7-year-olds. Mm-hmm. I don't think I want to do it alone. Hopefully I have a partner. I hopefully have a loving Jewish husband as you yes. do. But you're a father of two. Mm-hmm. And it's not an easy road.
No, I'm so tired right now.
You're so tired.
What time is it? If I wasn't here, where would I be?
Asleep.
Right now.
Right now.
Right this moment. Dream two.
So you got to deal with, you got to deal with a racial reckoning. You got to deal with your career blowing up. You got to deal with a beautiful husband who has his own life,
yes.
and now two children yes. that you didn't grow and just mm-hmm. You had to fight for them.
Yes. Still fighting for them.
Still fighting.
Still happening. I had a lawyer call right before I came. Yes. Still fighting.
So what is the difference between fostering to adopt and then just adopting?
So fostering to adopt means that you're going through the LA County. We live in LA, so the LA County foster system, which means anytime you're getting a baby or a child out of the LA County foster system, it means that there is a family on the other end that is going through some traumatic event. You're never getting a kid from just a person who decided it was time to give up their child. You're always getting a kid from an emergency situation. So that can mean that the mother is homeless. It can mean the mother is on drugs, so the baby is born in a hospital, tests positive for any number of things. It could mean that there's spousal abuse. It could mean that a teenager was kicked out of their house for being gay. It's emergency. You get an emergency call. You go onto a list as a foster parent, and they can call you.
And are you on that list from age 0 to 18, or do you
Well, you tell them
range?
What you want. You tell them what you want. And so Matt and I said we wanted a baby. We actually initially said we wanted a toddler. Mm-hmm. And our social worker was like, nah, you guys need a baby because you're traveling too much. And I think that your life has to be more stable to take an older kid or a toddler. You can't just be jumping on planes and performing.
Right.
All
a
over
baby
the-
can just like
a baby you can strap on and
wrap
take.
Up. That's true.
So we ended up getting two babies from the hospital.
Babies.
Galileo was 5 days old. Apollo was like a week old. We picked them both up from the hospital.
And is it the kind of situation where they tell you every single thing that happened?
They tell you all that they know.
All that they know.
All that they know. And of course, that story changes throughout the initial months, years, right? It just changes. They don't know anything. Sometimes it's a safe surrender. A baby, you know, there's a law here in California where you can drop a baby off at a fire station, no questions asked. Police station.
So that's a foster baby, not an adoption
baby.
That
would be a foster, then that kid would be in the foster care system. An adoption is when you've paid to work through an agency and they find women who are pregnant and they know they can't take care of kids and they're like, I'm looking for a home for this child and I know that I'm going to have this baby and then you will come and get him or her, right? So that's a private adoption. What Matt and I have done is the foster care system. We've navigated insane experiences. And I wish that the system was easier because I really think it's like perfect for gay men and women, anyone in that LGBTQ spectrum, it's perfect for us because it's not, it's free. So it's not $30,000. It's not surrogacy, which is hundreds.
Right.
It can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. I had a friend on the phone. She called me yesterday from St. Louis and she said, you know, we're considering foster care, but, you know, my husband is unsure of if he can love another person's child. And she said, I hope I'm not offending you. And I said, oh, of course I'm not offended. It's a question. You got to ask some real shit when you want to like take somebody as kid. It goes away in 2 seconds. That question is answered in 2 seconds. They hand you a baby. The baby is this big. And you're like, okay, this baby does not have anything to do with the madness of all of these adults.
This baked potato is now mine.
This baked potato is yours to care for. And you don't have any question. It's like if someone hands you a puppy, do you go like, ah, I don't know if I'm going to love this
It didn't
puppy.
Grow in my butthole. Yeah.
Correct. So like... You're gonna get a baby or a child or a teenager or whatever you're getting, whatever you want, whatever you feel called to.
But the cost of the foster system is that the biological parent has access to get their shit together for how long? Forever?
Every case is different.
Really?
Every case is different. My oldest son, he is 3 and a half and he is still not adopted. We have not been fighting his biological mother, his birth mother. She very early on said, I want you guys, I want the gay couple to have my baby. But, you know, she had a family member who is fighting for the child. So that's not going to happen. Our baby is staying.
Who makes that decision? A judge?
Judges, DCFS workers, county workers, social workers. It's like a, it's a whole process. But the... The birth family can continue to file appeals. So our oldest son has been caught in appeals for years. Wow. So we had to hire a private lawyer, and the private lawyer has now had to go appeal to the Supreme Court of the state of California to get this family member to stop filing appeals because it's just, it's never going to happen and it's delaying permanency. Wow. So that's our oldest son. Our youngest son, we've had no family visits. We've had no resistance. He will be adopted any day now. So it just,
so it's case
every
by case.
Case is different. And so you don't know when you sign up to do it, you're signing up for whatever the roller coaster ride is.
And when you sign up, you say, what are you signing up for? I want a baby between this and this. And that's all you say?
You sign up. First of all, you have to get certified to become a foster parent. They do a background check. They got to do your house check. They want to make sure your house is safe. You have to learn about what the system is and what it means to take on a child if you're interested in a teenager. They train you to go like, this is what might happen. You might get this teenager and then this is what they'll do. And this is how will you, these are the services that are available to you when your teenager is doing this or when your 3-year-old is acting out. And, you know, these kids are coming from traumatic experiences. And so they're going to, some of them will act out.
As fucked up as our society is, it's amazing that taxpayer money like helps, like this whole system exists to help kids.
It exists, and most people don't know that it exists. Wow. There are 40,000 kids in LA County. 40,000. When we got certified as foster parents, we got certified on a Friday at 3:00. Our social worker said, "So it'll be a couple of weeks before we really, you know, find a baby, and we'll work through you." I was at happy hour. It was 5:00. She called
the same day.
The same day, and said, "I have a baby."
You need to tell your me, son, that your current
yes.
son? No. Hey,
baby, do you want him to say yes or no now?
Say die. Yes or no now.
Die.
What are you saying yes or no to? Like,
are you taking this baby, yes or no?
No.
And so thank God it was a Friday. So we had the whole weekend to get, we said yes. We had the whole weekend to get ready because they don't discharge kids on Fridays after 5:00. And so we picked him up on Monday. We had no car seat. We had no crib. We had no changing table.
Oh my God.
We were not prepared. Because she said it's going to be weeks. No.
Okay, well, I have a lot to think about.
Well, you're going to be a great parent.
What I'm saying, first of all, thank you. What I'm saying is that while you were speaking, I was realizing it's happening again.
What is?
Which is, when I met you 20 years ago, I was like, he's ahead of me, right ahead of me, in a way that is close enough that I can see it.
Mm.
And now you fostering kids, I'm like, oh my God, I'm so lucky that I have this person that can speak my language, but then also teach me and also do the hard lift, the heavy lifting, so they can just, it's like, teach me what to do. I love you.
I love you more.
Thank you for doing this.
You're perfect.
Okay, we've done it again. Wasn't that great? Griffin is the one. Okay, whatever. See you next week.